What does it mean? I think it means like this. That, you see, he's talking about the very problem that he started to discuss before. Namely, that man's drive would really have it that the world should be set up in a totally different way. That a person strives and accomplishes, he should be the one that has the accomplishment, and not another person to gain it by chance. and that his success should stem from his efforts. That would seem to be the logical way.
The
logical way and the just way to set up the world. Not the kapoya, that this guy works and the other guy gets it. You see? He says, well, why does God do it? He says, well, ki masa shayir mofana. But God made it this way that people should fear him. What it means is like this, that if the world was constructed, first of all, he says like this. He says, see, what he prefaces his statement with, I know that everything that God made, you can't add, you can't subtract. What he means to say is that the way God created the universe is with perfect chokhmah, utmost chokhmah. And there's nothing that a person can say, if only this was that way, and if only that was another way. That's nonsense. A person who's a fool keeps on lamenting over the fact, why did it have to be this way? Why couldn't it have been another way? Why? Because the whole universe is this way. You know, a person doesn't realize that everything that takes place according to the laws of the entire system. That type of knowledge is not humanly possible. A person can't understand that in the first bits of creation, the first bits of matter, the way it was set up with so much chokhmah and such precision that a whole universe should be able to unfold and that we should be able to be here today to study Galilee. A person doesn't understand that it's out of the realm of human knowledge, how such a thing could be possible. And science is able to take little steps and unravel little points, but the total picture can only be seen by God. So since that's the case, so it is foolish for a person to say, if only this was that way, if only that was that, another way. But he says, nevertheless, he says, what it means is, sometimes we can find in life a benefit. See, that's why, like the Rav one time mentioned, he says that that the chinuch uses the term sharashei hamitzvos, not tamei hamitzvos, because tam means I understand the causal relationship between an idea and a mitzvah. We have no right to say that. We are on a level to formulate such a thing. If God created the mitzvah, so who are we to say this is the reason? It's nonsense. But sharashei hamitzvos means the roots of the mitzvahs, the benefits. A person has a right to see certain benefits. You can say this is a benefit which derives from such and such a situation. That's true. And even though God may not have done it for that purpose, but it could be that was a benefit that was considered in the entire picture. So a benefit, a person has a better chance at coming to, but not a causal reason. That's why he says like this. That's why he prefaces his statement. He says, well, what he's saying is like this, that there is a benefit in the way the system is set up. Because if the system was set up in a way that man can accomplish what he really wants, and the results are such that according to the effort, that's the way the result is, there would be no fear of God. Because man would be so overcome with his own sense of power, that he would never be able to submit mentally to a greater reality, and he'd be missing the entire scope of reality. So therefore it had to be this way in order that man should not have the satisfaction which he really desires, because if he did, he would be robbed of the view of the picture of reality, and he would never submit to the Creator. He'd never submit to that which he is, to the system of which he occupies a small part of.
Yeah, but on the whole, you see, your effort can bring you to
the same. And is not really a good example, I'll tell you why, because the point is, the problem with Ayn Rand is what is considered the good. In other words, what is the benefit? The benefit, what she considers to be a benefit, is to look at the New York skyline. But she's not going to question as to whether that, in fact, is a benefit. Okay? That's the point is that if you assume that that is a benefit, then you have a right to assume that, sure, it came through man's ability, it came through man's work and through his achievement. But what Stone Mellow is questioning is, what came through his work and his achievement? And what benefit is there? If you're overcome by the fantasy, so then you'll say, yes, it's a great thing. Look what the person accomplished. That's like, and that is true. He can really accomplish. But is that considered an accomplishment? And it, does it have any value in terms of human happiness? That is what Shmuel Melech attacks. He doesn't attack the fact that there is accomplishment. Certainly there's accomplishment. If it wouldn't be for man's drive, man would not accomplish what he has. That's true. But the question is, what benefit does he gain? My Yisrael. What benefit other than the fact that he's positive that this is a great accomplishment? But let's really analyze and see how that accomplishment worked and how it helped those people who've given their lives for this thing.
No, but I was telling you a little quote.
Oh, with regard to the instances, it doesn't work. In other words, in particular instances, it doesn't always work. In particular instances,
it doesn't always work.
Not only doesn't always work, all the questions he asked before. In other words, if I had control over my life, that every effort that I put into my life, I'm going to die in a few years, and I'm going to leave it over to somebody else. If I had a way to control that, to leave it over to who I wanted to, one would think that should be the way it should be. That should be the natural order. Why isn't the natural order that way? So he says, no, because if I was able to do that, then I'd be so tied to my fantasy of my own powers that I'd never be able to recognize a reality outside of myself. And that would be the worst thing for man. That's why Shlomo HaMelech over here, he's positing something else. Actually, he's taking up another note. After he's finished showing the whole problem of existence, he says, but you shouldn't think that the reason why God made it this way is wrong. No, there is a very good reason. Because man's nature is such, that drive, it also shows, demonstrates the power of the drive. That drive is so powerful that if reality would support it in any way, any small way, he would never be able to see God. Because he would be completely overcome by his own power. So that's why the frustrations in life serve a very good benefit. The losses, of course, in terms of his own satisfaction and his own personal happiness, but the gain is a different type of happiness. The gain is the ability to see an entire screen, and it's frustrating. As a matter of fact, I remember a quote from Albert Einstein where he says that the reason why a person becomes a philosopher or a person turns to thought is because of the frustrations of the external world. That's what he said. He said, because a person who's interested, he says, really, a thinker also starts off. He's a child, he has the instincts, he has the emotions. But he says, the frustrations of the external world and seeing the imperfections and how things don't work out causes the person to retreat into a different world where things really work out. And that is the world of ideas. That's what Albert Einstein one time mentioned. That point, to see that point is that's the point to tell us. Why is it that the life is so frustrating and the whole system doesn't work out? If God hadn't made it that way, then we would never be able to see a greater vision. We'd never be able to see the rest of reality. We'd be stuck in our own small circle. That's what the problem is. All right.
So Sunday Shir, November 23rd. Kohelas, we're on Gimel, Per Gimel. Per Gimel, you're
all right. Next part of the talk.
I just don't understand the puzzle. There's something here that I just can't get to the bottom of it. And Yudalit, he says, he says he recognizes the fact that whatever God has made, you can't subtract or add to it. Which means that he came to the conclusion of the fact that there is a you see in the Pasuk Yedaleh, where he says, I know that whatever God has done, it will be forever. It's eternal. All of him lahosu from memeno and legroa. You can't add or subtract from it. What he means is that a person who is a chacham comes to the conclusion that it is futile to be upset about details. In other words, a person who is a fool is always disturbed about particulars. Why did this particular happen? Why did that particular? Why couldn't it have been this way? Why couldn't it have been another way? So a person who is foolish, who doesn't see the whole picture, he always insists that a certain point of reality could have been changed. Because that point, of course, is the point that he wishes would be changed, so that his emotions would be satisfied. So he says, no, he says, Yadati, whatever God has made, hu yela olam. It means that everything is based on a system of eternal law. And all of Ein Lahosif, you can't add anything to it or subtract from it. So that it is foolish for a person to think of a particular incident or particular event, particular occurrence, and to think to himself, if only it would have been otherwise. Because if he would see the entire scheme of things, the eternal laws from which everything is generated, he realized that those laws dictate the particulars. So the particulars that occur can't be changed. It's only a foolish person who looks at reality with his emotions. He isolates a piece of reality, and that piece of reality is not something which satisfies him. It goes against him. So he has a desire that if only that bit of reality was different. See? Like a person who goes on vacation and thinks to himself, if only it didn't rain today. You see? He doesn't recognize that the rain is based upon a system of law, of eternal law. It has nothing to do with him. But the emotions isolate a specific phenomena, a specific part of reality, and his wishes direct his mind only to that part of reality as if that was a separate entity. Which really didn't have to be that way. Why did it have to happen to me that way? Why did this happen? It was a bad day. I had a bad day that day. You see? He doesn't recognize that all those particulars which he's talking about stem from eternal laws. And you can't add a fraction to it, and you can't subtract anything from it. Okay? That's Pasuk Yadalit. So he says that a person, so therefore the only approach that a wise person takes is that he looks at the whole, not at the particular, and he subordinates his own emotions to the system, and recognizes that things can't, particulars can't be changed, and it's futile and wasteful for a person to lament over particulars, because the particulars are only results of the universals, and the universals are the old ones; they can't be changed. Yes. The implication that he's giving over here is, you see what he says, Vasher Lios Faroya, whatever will come eventually already was. What he means to say is, in a similar vein, it's an extension, he's saying that when an evil occurrence takes place, it also goes according to the laws of nature. So therefore, things that will occur already have taken place. What he means by have taken place, he means to say that it's part of an immutable law. Okay? Masha what?
Cause is already in place.
Cause is already in place. So therefore, and what does he say? He says God will take retribution from the oppressor.
What's the point of it? We already said the cause.
But we have hopes for the future, something different is going to happen. He says that's nonsense, because the point is just like that which was in the past has already occurred, and what he means by occurred means the fact that it has occurred shows that it's immutable, you cannot change it. Whatever will happen is also immutable. The future is just as immutable as the past. That's what he's saying. See, Rashi learns Pshat like that. Rashi says that Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Meshana Midos HaVolam. Says God doesn't change his ways in the world.
It
doesn't change. So therefore, the future is an immutable reality. Now, okay, that's fine, that's fine. The only thing is, why does he bring in that God will search out for the one that was oppressed? I mean, what does that have to do with anything? You see, that's a difficulty in the puzzle. He would seem to be saying that if a person is going, some evil is going to befall a person, there's no way that he can avoid it. You see? There's no way to avoid the evil that will befall him. And that's why he says, but God will take retribution from the evildoer. But the fact, but the victim has no way of avoiding it. You see, that's basically what he seems to be saying. In other words, the point that he's making is basically that since Bechira Chofshis was given to man, free will, and free will is an immutable law, so it turns out that the person who is the victim of another person's evil choice in his Bechira has no way of escaping. And that's what he seems to be saying.
That's not the point that he's stressing.
Of course, of course, of course. That's what he's saying, the road is going to be punished. True. But the point that he seems to be making based upon the last pasuk and what he seems to be saying over here in the first part of the pasuk is that there's no way to be avoided. That there's no way to be avoided. This idea, I mean, presents a lot of problems from a philosophical standpoint. In terms of Hashgacha, it seems to be a denial of the Hashgachas Hashem, because it's saying that a person that is a good person to be harmed by another person's ability to make a free choice. That's basically the problem of the pasuk. However, according to the Rambam's Shita, according to the Rambam's concept of Hashgacha, it doesn't really pose such a serious problem. As a matter of fact, the Rambam would support this concept, because the Rambam maintains that the Hashgachas Hashem, that while it is true that man is under the sway of divine providence, but that divine providence only works in a very special manner. And the way that it works is by a person being on a certain wavelength where he's involved in the Chachma and Chachmas Hashem, and insofar as there is a relationship between him and God, he's above the natural law, because he's in a realm which is actually higher than natural law, the realm which is responsible for the natural law, and somehow through that relationship he can avoid at certain times, the Rama qualifies it, can avoid the evil which will ordinarily befall him. If that is the case. Then what Shlomo Melech is discussing is simply the general rule. In other words, that it is true that there is, not that he's denying Hashgacha, the philosophical Hashgacha, but rather he's saying that according to general law, since most people in general are not under the Hashgacha only insofar as they partake of Chachmas Hashem, but in most of the things that they do, they don't, so therefore it is immutable. The future is immutable, and they simply can't escape. That wouldn't be too difficult if you accept the Rambam's opinion on the Shkafa Sashem. Okay? Alright, that's it. That's basically, I can't do any more with it, without fussing. Okay. Part of the whole system. So too his future is immutable. That's a natural, the second pasuk naturally carries the idea that he mentioned in the first pasuk further. Because even though a person is willing to accept the present, somehow his emotions don't want to accept the fact that the future is immutable. So therefore, it's a conclusion that follows naturally the previous question. Okay.
Yeah. That a guy does tshuva or mispalo, that doesn't change his... I don't understand that.
That's the Ram's idea of Hashgacha. I mean, that's a separate thing. Of course, Shiva helps. Shiva helps because it raises him to a higher level, but insofar as it places him under the Hashgacha. But he's not discussing that point. In other words, that's true. Under those are certain circumstances. But on the whole, it's not so. Like the Rambam, for instance, It doesn't mean necessarily that the Shlomo Melech is discussing a case where a person died, necessarily. It depends on the different events. It could be he lost money. It could be some other untoward event. But the Rambam explains the depends upon the level of the person and what the particular event is. He says only the avos were on such a level that every single thing that they did was under the Ashgava. Because for them, every particular action which they did and everything which they partook of affected their rationality. Because everything they did, they only lived for Chacham. But the average person, who most of his life is really, most of the things he does is unrelated to Chachma, so insofar as it's unrelated to Chachma, really has nothing to do with Ashgachas Hashem. And therefore, it's Ma Shehoya Kvaru. Vasher Yi, Vasher Lios, Kvaroya. As if it occurred already, there's no way to change it. Okay, let's go further. Now it's a little good. Vod Roisi Tachas Hashem. Seeing something else. Mekoma Mishpat Shomo HaResha. The place of justice, there is the evil. And the place of righteousness, that is where one finds evil. All right, what's the meaning of the pasuk? What is he trying to bring out? What do you mean in the place of justice? The relationship between the pasukim. But let's just try to take each pasuk by itself. What he means is as follows, that man's desire for justice is not really an inherent desire for the thing itself, but he's really motivated by something else altogether. He's motivated by the same emotions that motivate the person that is in search for material gain. Namely his desire for honor. And his desire for honor, which is based upon his fantasy of immortality, that he should be a great person. So that it turns out that the institutions of justice really are there, from a psychological standpoint, just to satisfy those people and to give them the aura and the respect from the other people that they are just individuals. Therefore, they will always be just insofar as they attain their goal. But once they're in a situation where where their very goal might be thwarted, then the whole justice topples. The whole system of justice topples. So that if the institution itself is in danger, then you will see that they will not proceed according to justice. See? Like you find many times like a person finds corruption in institutions that are supposed to represent justice and righteousness. What does that demonstrate? It demonstrates one thing. It demonstrates that their desire for the justice and the desire for the righteousness, so justice really means in a secular way, like a court of law. Makom HaTzedek means the place of righteousness, like a religious institution. Righteousness means a religious institution. So he says that these institutions, there is no institution, there is no place that man can find where he can say that this place is free from human corruption. Because on the contrary, because human corruption has a very subtle disguise. The motivation is the same thing. The same motivation. Motivation is to appear as a just person or to appear as a righteous person. But if that very institution becomes endangered, so then there's no benefit anymore for the person to follow justice. And then he will become corrupt. That's like you find, all too often you find that a place of Torah where there's corruption in terms of and monetary corruption. Why? Because the point is they feel that they must survive. They must survive. But that's not really love of justice. The point is the desire to survive is really nothing more than another expression of a person's fantasy of immortality. Except he didn't take it in a gross manner. In other words, in terms of a material desire, but it's disguised through the facade of righteousness and justice. That's basically what he is. That's basically what he's saying. What he means to say is that there is no escape from this desire, the fantasy of immortality. There is no place that is exempt from it. Okay. Now he goes on to different things. So like this, Amarti ani believi as a tzaddik v'asa rasha yishkod
alakim. What was the case
with
Rashi?
Sar, what was it? Sar sakim rav saras nirgol sharetzer v'nesha v'yelazer v'nei sel b'yisu and kashim mishpeh mavas shema rasha kama l'malu v'ma shehu shem v'vaz m'vaz. It's the same idea. What's the problem? I don't see the problem. What do you want from Rashi? The Migdash also had the same phenomenon. The Migdash was destroyed because it became a place of corruption. Because the people wanted the honor and the prophet to have the Migdash run. People of the Kohen Gadol, there were briberies going on in order to be the Kohen Gadol. Okay. He says, that I said in my heart that God will judge the righteous and the wicked. Meaning to say that while it's true that there is no place that is exempt from corruption, nevertheless, God will judge. God is a judge. Okay? So therefore, that was his solace. That was a solace. It's true that in terms of man, you can't find such a thing. But God is the ultimate judge, and that's the and then there's no problem. He says, oh yes. Then he goes on another pasuk. This is an interesting pasuk. Amatani believi al divras b'nei ha'adav. I said in my heart, al divras means it comes from dovar, the thing. Al divras b'nei ha'adav, about the thing about man. Now, levorom ha'elokim v'liros. Shehem behema hema lahem. That's what I read. Yeah. What does it mean? It means like this. You see? Levorom ha'olokin, it's unclear because of the dictum. It's unclear as to what exactly levorom ha'olokin means. But there are two possibilities. Levorom ha'olokin means, levorom means, it comes from the word to choose. Varam, clarify, to choose. Levorom ha'olokim. One shot is that the subject is God. Levorom ha'olokim, which means that God has chosen them. That's the way the Ibn Ezra learns. He means like this. Vinyano, he says like this. Amati b'libei avot b'nei adam shebocharom ha'olokim. About people that God has chosen them. Rashi learns the other child, Levorom Holokim, which means that that they have chosen God. Okay, but either way, basically, you'll see it doesn't really make that much difference. What does it mean? He says, the Liros, and to see Shehem Behemo Hemalayim, that they are to themselves, Shehem Behemo, they are like Behemos. They are to themselves like behemoths. What does this mean? You see, the Ibn Ezra, I think, is the clearest expression of it. He says, not to believe that Adam should buffer him told us Haaretz. Because of man who God has chosen from all the from all those creatures of the earth, Ruisi, and I saw Shehen Kamo Behemos Hamlin Nachshon, Bemach Shivosom. That they are to themselves like animals. Alright? Now, what he's saying is as far, I think both, it doesn't make any difference really which way you look. But what he's really attacking here is the, what people refer to, the sanctity of man. In other words, that man feels that he is chosen by God as a special creature. He's different. He's not a behemoth. He's much higher. The higher aspects of human nature, of a person's nature, which makes him feel a certain sense of superiority. It's expressed also either way. Either levorom ha'olokim means that God has chosen him, that the people feel that they are separate, they are different than than the rest of the creation, or it means insofar as man himself has chosen God, meaning godly traits. In other words, I would say it even is a reference, essentially a reference to the religious emotion in man. Because the religious emotion in man, the religious desire in man, stems from the concept that man is a totally different type of creature, a superior creature. So he has a different nature. And basically, behind the religious drive is, and behind every religious drive, I mean, there's always the concept that man is different, that man is actually differentiated and infinitely superior to the rest of the creation. The religious platform is one which has to which maintains that, because that's the whole idea of religion. And man is different. You say man is like an animal, there's no system. So all religions basically always maintain that. Now what he says is like this. He says the liros and to see shehem behemahem alahem, that really they are in their thoughts like behemos, that it is false. There is no such thing. It's just what? Yeah, and that's possible for the rest. That really it is false, because if you analyze human life over here, what he breaks down is the idea, the concept that man is is essentially and instinctually to be separated from the animal kingdom. He says it's not true. Why? Because as the Ibn Ezra says, if you take a look at Machshavosim, if you make an honest evaluation, that they are like animals in their thoughts. That really, their inner strivings and their inner thoughts, if a person would be honest with his thoughts, he would find that basically it could be reduced. Everything that he does could be reduced to an animalistic instinctual source. And that this concept that man is inherently superior instinctually, he's not, in other words, he doesn't have base instincts, but rather he has a spirituality about him. He refuses to accept this concept. What he maintains is that the spirituality of man really can be traced to animalistic instincts. That's basically what he said. Shan behemar, that they to themselves, they are like. Well, the reason why he says hema lahem, he doesn't say shehem behemos, because hema lahem implies to themselves, which means in their innermost thoughts. That if a person will take an analysis of the innermost thoughts of people, he will discover the strong instinctual roots of those thoughts. And therefore, he must maintain.
There's two parts to
the human personality. In other words, there's a part of the human personality which is an emotional makeup, and then there's a part of the human personality which is the seichel halaki, man's ability to see truth. The greatness of man only lies in that sphere. That's why, and that is the reason why a person who is a truly great person is also a very humble person. Because the egoism stems from his making a mistake in his own identification and in thinking that egoism stems from a person feeling that a certain part of his nature is superior, namely the emotional part. A person who recognizes that his emotional part is not really superior, it means that he's withdrawn his self into another part of the mind, the part that only sees Chokhmah. When he does that, on the contrary, his whole self seems like nothing. So there is There is greatness in men, but there is no greatness in men which satisfies what man really wants to feel. He really wants to feel that he's a spiritual creature. You see? And that's what the religions preach. That's why the religions are really very haughty. They're very audacious, the religions, because what they preach is that they are endowed. They sense a certain feeling of superiority over other people. They sense that superiority in their nature, in their psychological nature, and that's what leads to haughtiness. But if a person would, only sense that the greatness of man lies purely in that part which recognizes chokhmah, he wouldn't sense any haughtiness. On the contrary, he'd look at the other part of his nature, which is his essential psychological drive, and he'd see what it is, and his opinion of himself would be reduced. The only haughtiness that's possible is where a person actually feels that the psychological part of his nature is superior. See? So Moshe, on the contrary, so Moshe Rabbeinu was Anu Mikolada. But the higher a person reaches in that knowledge and understanding, the lower the self-esteem becomes. The self becomes like something which he observes as a corrupt substance. Okay? Because it feels a certain sense of superiority.
That's why there's the concept of a champion.
What is a champion? A champion is he who has not been beaten. Why? Because the moment he's lost, it already is a break in the fantasy of his greatness. Undefeated is a champion. That's a man's egoism. But that's a simple thing. Everybody thinks that's ridiculous. What he's trying to show is that there is one area where people think that they're getting away from this, and that is the area of religious spirituality. But that carries with it the same haughtiness, and really it can be traced to the same source. And basically it's the same drive, because in their innermost thoughts, if you analyze their innermost thoughts, it could always be traced to the same animal. That's basically what it says. Shame behem hamalan. Okay. Now, it's a further breakdown of the religious emotion, showing that the religious emotion in man is basically just a disguise, another disguise of the instinctual force, which is based on his narcissism and his tendency of immortality. Now he goes on. This part we took left on. Ki nikra b'nei ha'adam nikra b'hema u'mikra echad lahem k'mose ki nikra b'nei ha'adam nikra b'hema k'mose k'mose v'ruch echad l'kol u'mose ha'adam b'nei ha'adam nikra b'hema k'mose. Now, since everything could be traced in man, all his essential nature could be traced to the instinctual, so there's no difference really between man and the animal. And therefore, k'mose k'mose, doesn't make any difference what kind of a system, instinctual system you carry with you, whether your instinct is to build a nest or your instinct is to think that you're a very spiritually important person. Since it's all based on instinct, so this type of thing has to die with the body, because it's a physical phenomenon. And there's no difference between the man and the animal. Okay? Then he goes, okay, we took that. Miyodea ruach b'nei ha'adam oli l'malo, this we taught. That the miyodea. Miyodea means not that he's denying the fact that there is immortality, but the nature of the immortality that there is dependent totally on das, on knowledge. It's an abstract idea, and it depends on, it's purely an intellectual perception. It can only be perceived intellectually. But it does not give man any emotional satisfaction. That's why he says that that there is nothing. This is the culmination of the fact that there's nothing in life really that is eternal, and that man is on a completely hopeless path trying to find that thing. All right. Now we say like this. Then Risa came. Okay, so the conclusion is that the only thing that a man can do is basically to enjoy that which he has and live a temporal existence and think only of the temporal. Okay? And think only of the temporal. Yes, that's the conclusion. Yeah. What he's saying over here is
You see, what is the important idea in all these things? He uncovers all the disguises of the fantasy of immortality. But by doing that, he shows you a very interesting thing. Namely, that a person, it's not easy for a person to, not only not easy, I mean, he's basically saying it's psychologically impossible, I would say, for a person to live without that fantasy. No matter what he does, it's going to, somehow or other, it's going to be expressed. And that's the concept of Yisra. Now, a person like Bertrand Russell, who, even a philosopher, I'm just using it as an example, even a philosopher who fancies himself to be a realist, but in his life you'll notice that he is not devoid, very seldom is he devoid of the idea of Yisra. Of the idea of Yisra. Bertrand Russell was very interested in making changes in the world. This was a very important thing to him. He had he considered himself. He was interested in making changes. He was excited about his work. And anyone that's any type of excitement is a disguise, basically, for Yisra. Yisron is almost impossible to avoid. Even people who maintain that they're realists, the psychology of man is such that somehow or other there is always some expression of the Yisron. It is psychologically impossible for a person to completely remove the Yisron from his life. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't... See, the philosophy that he adopts stems from one compartment of his mind. The mistake that the philosophers make, and this is what Kohelis really was trying to amend. The mistake that philosophers make is that they assume that if they have a certain knowledge, that therefore their emotional makeup will follow. That assumption is what he's against. He says that assumption is not true. So therefore, even though the person has the knowledge, but to go against, he may be able to make certain changes, and he may be able to have certain improvements. But to totally go against his nature, this is an almost impossible task. He's not saying what he's supposed to do at this point. He's just saying, in other words, that's basically the dilemma. The dilemma is that it comes from two separate compartments. He's compartmentalized. In other words, they're two separate compartments of his mind. So even though intellectually he's going to maintain one thing, but the drive is not rationalized, and the drive will always find some loophole, some expression. That's why you find people who are, what happens is that people who are philosophers, even those who maintain their philosophy, they become very involved in the importance of perpetuating this philosophy. And that importance itself is where the Yisron has been able to express itself. It is very difficult to escape it. That emotion, that drive itself is the Yisra. There are very few people who have gone through this world that are non-Yisron people. They're non-Yisron people. That was Shlomo Melech, was the greatest realist. He was able to do it. But I want to mention also that a person should, when a person studies Kohelis, so because of that, there's a very great chance that a person could become depressed. Because he feels helpless. How could he get out of it? What could he do? Well, you have to realize that the person has to realize, first of all, that with every bit of knowledge he improves himself, and secondly, that he shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that just because he attains the knowledge, he's immediately going to reverse or change his instinctual. You have to realize in terms of that. He has to recognize that especially when a person is younger, I mean, a person has to follow. If a person would just do nothing, then he'd be completely devastated. That's why he says, I'll teach the carpet, that a person shouldn't be too righteous, because then he needs the instincts in order to get him moving. But the progress is slow. It might not be complete, but whatever progress he makes is beneficial, but he can't just abandon his own instincts. Nevertheless, he shouldn't really turn his mind's eye away from his nature. He should know what his nature is and keep it in the back of his mind. And then he has to go on. I mean, he has to... what? Exactly. Yes, Michael.
you first you want to be a real person.
That's why religion always and immortality always goes together. It always goes together. Because it always caters to that emotion. If he feels like a behemoth, then he's going to die like a behemoth. So therefore, he makes himself into a different type of creature, an ethereal type of creature. He's
that's
a spiritual creature.
And that's all because he has a feeling of wanting to be another.
Exactly. Because he has desire for another.
Are you surprised to see any kind of feeling of the greatness that a person has, it comes from that?
Comes from that thought. Right. Yeah. The example is, you see, for instance, the way when Galileo made his discoveries. When Galileo, you see astonishingly, when Galileo made his discoveries at the church, when they tortured him, they made him recant, tortured the man. And, of course, he made a discovery about the universe. I mean, what is it his fault if he's able to see some chokhmah of the universe? But they couldn't tolerate it. They couldn't, Copernican Revolution, they couldn't tolerate that idea. Why? Because you see clearly, I mean, it's not just an isolated instance. That shows you that the whole drive of the church, the whole drive of the religious drive is to deny man's basic instinctual nature and to maintain that he's essentially, psychologically, a different type of creature. He has a certain psychological superiority. And that's why also you'll find that people will always, everybody has a different personality, and everybody will always laugh at the other person's personality. So his personality is the right one, the other one's wrong. That's part of the feeling that his essence, because if a person feels that his essence is a psychological makeup, so a person has another type of personality, he does this way, I do this, I do it in a better way, all this type of nonsense is all basically the same from Zenma. Yes. They have to recognize that too. But the ultimate thing is that through that recognition you truly become great. The final way, the final is very nice to admit your faults and to admit your weakness and admit your inferiority. As long as the ultimate goal, in the end, you wind up on top. Person has another type of personality. He does this way, I do this, I do it in a better way. All this type of nonsense is all basically the same from Zenma. Yes. They have to recognize that too. But the ultimate thing is that through that recognition you truly become great. The final is very nice to admit your faults and to admit your weakness and admit your inferiority. As long as the ultimate goal, in the end, you wind up on top and immortal. You can say anything else before that, doesn't matter. That's their method. Everyone has his way of going. Yisron is ubiquitous.
How can the
arts
feel themselves on a higher level
and more self-made? Yeah, probably. Yeah, more self-made. They feel superior that way. Just like people with etiquette. People are very big on etiquette also, a certain feeling of superiority. Because they convince themselves, you see, people who are into etiquette feel superior because they convince themselves that they've removed themselves from the basic animalistic desires. Mm-hmm. Of course, they've thrown themselves into egoism. But that they don't see so clearly as being another animalistic desire. Yes.
Miller highlights.
Now he seems to be going into something that has absolutely nothing to do with the main theme that he's of his book. The Shafti on the end says, "V'ayres kol ha'shukim asher nasim tachas ha'shamash." All the oppression that's done under the sun. Then he says, "V'nei dimas ha'shukim, and behold the tears of those who are oppressed. V'ein lahem menachem, there is no one to comfort them." And there's no way that they could. The strength resides in the hands of the oppressors, and there's no way that they can escape. What does that have to do with this? Is this social oppression? I mean, what is he discussing here? v'shabeach ani. Then he says, and then he suddenly says, v'shabeach ani esameisim shekvar meisim. Yeah, by the way, I mean, as I said many times, I mean, the idea of the, I mean, it's important, I know I'm mentioning it again, but I think it's extremely important. It's important to mention that Kohelis really is not, wasn't written for everybody. That's why everybody, you know, always quotes Sofdavar Kol Mishmar. And you have to be very careful. I mean, basically, Yadus is a Yadus, I never look at Yadus, I consider Yadus to be a religion. Yadus is really a very deep philosophy, philosophically, metaphysically, but it makes accommodations for a person's religious instinct. And it's important, though, to maintain those accommodations. I mean, the Pasuk says Yad Hashem, and Ram mentions it in the Mora. Why does the Pasuk say Yad Hashem? Why does the Pasuk describe God in such terms, yeah, in anthropomorphic terms? The reason is because You have to, in the system, you cannot reach a person unless you reach them on their level. And since most people are on that level, so you have to reach them on that level. But hopefully a person becomes more intelligent and sees a deeper meaning and understands more chokhmah. But a person should never undo that type of thing. It would be a very dangerous thing to undo that emotion. I mean, you could destroy a person. Okay. Now, the Shabbat is a mason, shekvar mason. He says, now he says, and I praise those who are dead, shekevar mesu, because they have already died. Min achayim ashehem achayim adenam. Then the living who are still alive. Yeah. It's an interesting thing. They said the shebech anis amesim shekevar mesu. I mean, I don't think anybody answers why he says shekevar mesu. What is the shebech anis amesim? What's the shekevar mesu? Shebech anis amesim min achayim ashehem achayim adenam. I think that the reason why he says the words Shekvar Mesa, that they have already died, he is making a reference to the fact that there's an instinctual drive that prevents man from doing away with himself. That's why if he says the Shabbat and he's a Mason, say, okay, so kill yourself. That is a Mason. But he's saying Shekvar Mesa. In other words, what he's saying is that he envies them. He envies them because they have already died, and it wasn't at their own hands. You see, what he's implying is that there is an instinct in man which prevents him from destroying himself, and therefore he was praising the dead that they have already gone through that. Shekvar Mesu. They have already. The only way that the man gives up his life is passively. Normal person only gives up his life passively, not actively. It's impossible for a normal person to give up his life actively to destroy himself. It's an impossibility. That's why he says it's a reference to that. It's an interesting thing. One of the latest psychologists makes that statement, that he maintains that it's an impossibility for a human being to destroy himself without any unconscious forces, but just to outright, even if he was totally rational and he decided that life is not worth it, it would be impossible for him to put an end to his life, because the instinctual energy would not permit it. Okay? The person that does it is usually doing it because they are not destroying themselves. But they're trying to destroy somebody else. They're trying to destroy. Actually, the act is an act of aggression towards somebody else. But the self becomes identified with that other person. The one that they're really destroying is the other person. Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I think that there's an allusion to that in this pasuk. There's an allusion to that in this pasuk by the two extra words, Shekvar Mesa. That's what it means. If he would have said the Shabbat and he's a Mason, so it would imply that I praise the dead so I can kill myself. No, what I envied was that they already died. I can't do away with myself. They already have gone through the process. So I envy them that they've gone through the process, even though I can't put an end to my own life. You see, that's what he's implying. Okay?
There are people that
So what do you need to say? What is the point you want to make here?
What's the nature of the Mishabeth? Isn't that what you're going to?
No, that's, he's saying the opposite way. He's saying that the Mason, if you gave him another chance, would never want to come back. That's what he's saying, basically. What he's saying is that the Mason, if you gave him another chance, would not want to return. They wouldn't wish to return. That's what he's saying. But the, why? Because they went through the process already. Yeah. As a matter of fact, this is Gemara implies. Gemara in the Maitatan, right? The Gemara says that one of the Amoraim died and he came back to life. So they asked him, they said, how was death? He said, death was nothing. It was like, gave a mushroom, like taking a hair out of a piece of cheese. I mean, like, it's cooked, the soul separated from the body. They said, I wouldn't want to go through it again. So why not? He says, because of the fear, pachad misa. But it means, I mean, that's that means to say, what it means to say is the fact that people stay alive is not really, the fact that people stay alive is not for a rational reason. It's simply because the instinct for survival is so great that they can't do away with themselves. But having passively undergone the process of death, they would not wish to return. That's what he's saying. They would not wish to return. Because they have an objective view. I can give you an example. I mean, most people, would they want to live their life over? I don't think they would say yes. Most people. I think if you'd ask them, I mean, I haven't taken a poll, but I think most people, if you'd ask them the life that they've had until now, if they'd want to live that life over again, most of them would say no. It's only they don't want to die because of the future life that they're expecting. But basically, the life they had, every day they go through the exact same things they get up to this point. I don't think most people would say they want to do it. Sure. If they had the choice, they would not want to do it. The only reason they don't want to die is because the future life is really something that is going to happen in the future. But to go through exactly day by day, step by step, what he went through until now, I don't think most people want to do it. That's my opinion. I haven't taken a poll, but I would guess that most people would not want to do it. That's why he goes on to say, the Tov Mishnayim Eis Asher Adem Lo Hoya, Asher Aros Amasa Arosh and Asatak Vashomesh. That's why he goes on to say that better than both of them is the one that never even had existence, because the whole of the existence is that's right, because the existence itself is not a good. Okay, now one second. Yes.
What do you say?
It means they are living against their will. They have to be living. That's what I think. It means to follow through from the first place. For Mesu, Chayim Adena. Okay? Now, the only question is, all very nice, and it really makes sense in terms of what he said before, because now he's bringing it to its, he's bringing the whole thing to a head, in other words. He's bringing it to its natural culmination, which is, what's the solution? Suppose this idea of mass suicide. Everybody's waiting for him to do this. You want to do it alone. But the philosophers. Yeah. Okay. These took him on a natural conclusion of the whole dilemma, which means that he can't follow the instinctual, because the instinctual is frustrating and is not in reality, and then simultaneously to abandon the instinctual, he has nothing to go on. So therefore, it's better off if he was dead. Okay. But what is, the only question is that there's one pasuk out of place. What does it have to do with Dalet Aleph does not belong here? Dalet Aleph is talking about the oppressed. And who cares? What does that have to do with anything? I mean, Ashukim said there's certain times you have oppression in certain societies, not every society. There's certain societies which are democratic, good societies, you don't have the oppression. But why is he mentioning about the people who are crying, that are oppressed, and nobody can help them? What does it have to do with this? So I really don't have an answer myself, but I'll tell you what the Ibn Ezra says, and you can evaluate it yourself. He says like this. It's a very interesting thing. He wants to say that the Shabbeach Anias HaMeisim Shekvar Mesa is not a reference to his philosophy. That he's just drawing his philosophy to its natural conclusion, that a person should envy the dead. That's not what it is. He says it really is a continuation of the first pasuk, the pasuk of the oppressed. It's an interesting. He throws the whole thing into a different framework. It's a very interesting psychological observation that he makes. He says like this. He says that. Let's take the next pasuk first. Just look at it briefly, and then we'll be able to go back. The Reisi Anias called Omo Ves called Kishron Amaisa. I've seen all the work and all the and all the activities. Kihi Kinas Ishmeri Eyo. Now, what is the source of all the activities? It's in one man's envy of another man. That's the basic root of a person's entire desire, and what makes it, what moves him. Gam Zehevel Urusro. Okay. Now, what he says is like this. He says that the reason that he says that the dead are better off than the living, who can they get hashukim? That's referring to the oppressed. He says, "Shekol odom yitkabel kol ma sheyavo olav min hashamayim." He says every person will accept anything that befalls him from God. He says, "V'lo yuchal lizbol oshek sheyasalo ben odom shehu kamol." He says, but he will not tolerate oppression at the hands of another man. Yivcham moves mechayim, and then he'll rather choose death than life. Give me liberty or give me death. You see, that's basically what he's saying. What he's saying is like he's saying it's an interesting phenomenon. He says, but a person, and you see it all the time. A person gets sick, very sick. He has a fatal illness. And he suffers, to be a prolonged illness, he suffers, he does suffer. But if another human being would be doing this to him, it would be completely intolerable. He would not be able to, tolerate. He would kill himself, then he'd rather choose death. This way, if he feels that this is the way it is, that God is, not so much the idea of God per se. It doesn't mean God in a religious sense, but that this is occurring to him. He's deteriorating. It's hard to adjust to it. He has complaints. It's hard to adjust. But somehow or other, he could do it. But could you imagine if another human being was causing him this pain and this torture? It would be intolerable. You see? That's what the Ibn Ezra says. An interesting psychological phenomenon. If a person will lose his money because of a chance occurrence, it will be painful to him. But if somebody else will rob it from him, it will be more than just painful. It will be intolerable.
They're both realities.
Right. But a person cannot accept the reality of another person oppressing him. That's how the Ibn Ezra interprets his sukkah. So he throws it into a different sphere altogether, puts it under a completely different light. If that's the case, so we have to understand. So why does he mention? Why does he mention this? What he's saying is like this. Actually, it's a continuation of what he said before. Kol hashayas alakim hu yelo olam, and volakim yivakash shnira, which means to say that man really thinks that he adjusts himself to reality, but he doesn't adjust himself to reality, because you see, when there's another human being involved, he can't accept the reality. He can't accept the reality the same way. Emotionally, he finds it intolerable. You see, why is that so? Because there is, you see, underneath the underlying psyche of man is that his success is, his whole life, his whole internal drive is a competitive one. That's why it fits in with the next part. The reason is called almost called Kifna Maisa Ki Hikinas Ishmerayo. He says, and I've seen all the efforts that man puts into life. What really drives him? Kina, envy. Which means to say that a person mostly does not do what is good for himself, but rather he does what the other person thinks is good for him. You see? All right. With what the other person, what humanity at large considers to be the reality. A person's drive, the drive in man is to be, the drive for success is really a relative drive. It's a drive which is based upon a reality, not a true reality, but a reality of what what other people value. So what's important to him in his framework is how, in the back of his mind, it's always a question of this enjoyment, how would they look at me? Is this something that people would envy me for? Would they really consider? That's the thing I want. See? If not, who cares about it? There's no, his drive is never in terms of what really his needs are. But rather, in the back of his mind, he has this
comparison.
In the back of his mind, he has this a totally different field, a totally different reality, and that's the framework that he works in. And it's because of that that it's intolerable for him to be suppressed by another human being. He can't look at it. He can't accept the reality. So even in an individual who thinks that he is that he's a realistic one, he accepts everything that befalls him in life. But he will not accept it if it's at the hands of another. That's right. Oh, go for the good. That's good for himself. Okay. But he says that the essential drive is the frame of his frame of reference is always the how people will look at him. That's the concern. Am I a success? How is this other guy look at me? And am I considered to be successful as this other guy? Doesn't matter whether I need this car. The question is, what car does he want? That's the one. That's the one that I need. Has nothing to do with his own good. Very little to do with his own good. That's basically the phenomenon. And that's why what he shows is what he's showing you. Of course, that's basically the same force that he's been discussing all along. Because it's all tied in with the fantasy mentality. Fantasy mentality means that he wants to be a great person vis-a-vis other people. So his sole preoccupation and concern is what status does he have vis-a-vis other people. And that's why he can't tolerate subordination by another individual. That's why he says, V'hine dimas ha'ashukim. The pasuk comes over next. Now we take a look at Dalet Aleph. V'hine dimas ha'ashukim. The tears of the oppressed. The ain lo and menachem. There's no one that can comfort them. What does he mean there's no one that can comfort them? He means there's no way to comfort such a situation. Because a person that is suffering at the hands of his fellow men, being oppressed by another person, and that other person knows that he's oppressing him, you see, there is no comfort for that emotion. Doesn't necessarily mean that the person, he's not talking about the situation where you have social injustice. It could mean in any situation. A person is at a job. A person's at a job. He has a job. Nice society, nice democratic society, and he's in a job. He's working on a job. But he has a boss. He has a boss on the job. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really, and that's why, that's basically why you are. You have so many problems in human relations. A person could give up a good job, very good job, one that would be beneficial for him, where he really gain in terms of his own needs. But there's one thing that he can't tolerate. That every day that he comes to work, he sees this boss, his boss is sitting there, and the boss enjoys pushing him around. Okay. He won't take, I don't care how much money he makes, he will not take that job. Just can't. And if he does take it, it's still intolerable. It's just that he's making a tremendous, tremendous sacrifice. But the emotion is there. Why can't he look at it as a piece of reality? Look, if it was raining outside, he'd have to walk to the job, wouldn't even think twice about it. I got a little wet, so what? Why can't he think about it in those terms? The answer is because it's basically man's egoism that drives him. And he can't look at the reality. There is no way to comfort a man in such a situation. And he reaches the point, he'd rather be dead. And that's what he said. Who was it, Patrick Henry? the whole idea of America. America's based on that idea. Give me liberty or give me death is based upon that same emotion. That's the emotion. Difficulties, I don't care. Liberty is fine. Go away from civilization, from a nice civilization, from England, go into the desert of places in the wilderness. Doesn't matter. But I'm a free man. How am I free? There's no one. I don't have to suffer the indignation, the human indignation that I have to subordinate myself to somebody, even though I have a better life over there being subordinated. No. That emotion I can't tolerate. It's foolish. It happens to be foolish. No question about it. I mean, that's really the problem with the emancipation. The problem with emancipation is that people believe that freedom is everything. Freedom isn't everything. And basically, if a person would be totally rational, he might find he could have a much better life being subordinated to somebody else to some independent extent. But I mean, he's not talking about it. What he's saying is it's not the extent. It's the idea that drives the person crazy. And therefore, it's completely irrational. Why is he irrational about it? He has to be irrational. Why? Because it's part of man's egoism. So the egoism is what drives him to a situation which could be less beneficial. Egoism drives him to a situation which could be less beneficial, but he's free. That desire for freedom is not really a... See, that desire is glorified, especially in this country. This country based on democracy. But you have to understand, it's just another emotion. Very nice, but countries are built on emotions. I mean, basically, that's the way it works. But it doesn't make it any more real, just because the entire country respects that idea. It's not true. It's not true just the same. It's all envy. Why is it envy? What do I care if the man next door to me has a better house or a better car? You see, why does it bother me? It bothers me for one reason. Because he thinks that I'm subordinated to him. This, when I walk out of my door, he looks at me like a poor slob, and he walks out classy, dressed. There's two types of subordination. There's direct subordination, and there's indirect subordination. You see? This is psychological subordination. I won't tolerate that. I will spend my last dollar. I don't care if I don't have what to eat, but he was not going to think that about me. You see? That is a kol kinas ish mereyo. That's what builds society. Okay. I'll stop there.
Now time to start the next tape. Whatever comes after here is inconsequential.
We're saying this on July 17th, 1988.
But don't worry, it's right.
Person's involved in striving after success, which is really has nothing to do with his own reality. It's just based upon what others value, which means he's actually working for others, not working for himself. Or else the other way is the person who says, I'm not going to get into the rat race. That's the other type of person. I'm not getting into this. He stands himself a chacham. But this person's a fool. Why? Because what happens to him is he has nothing. He has nothing. He has nothing in life. Because he doesn't have enough drive to go out and to...